Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we'll take a journey to talk with artists who've done some unusual projects around Appalachia. We'll hear from Jeff Pearson, who was a courtroom sketch artist during the trial of Don Blankenship.
I tend to exaggerate things a little bit visually, but with a man of this nature who's kind of a cartoon or a caricature, I'd be really careful not to do that. But I also think that sometimes you can capture someone's expression a little bit better by exaggerating.
We'll also hear from graffiti mural artist Patch Whiskey.
I mean, every mural that I do, I'm dropping rainbow monsters on people.
And we'll learn the story behind those iconic mail pouch tobacco signs you may have seen painted on barns on rural back roads.
Farmers were interested in having their barn painted, and we were interested in putting up the famous mail pouch barn sign, "Treat yourself to the best."
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. So this week for our show, we wanted to go on a kind of road trip and meet people who are making community art across Appalachia. We were especially curious to talk with some of the folks that help make outdoor murals. But along the way, we found a few surprises. Now, I won't give it all away just yet, but this was a really fun trip through the back roads of Appalachia.
Rolling down a backwoods Tennessee byway, one arm on the wheel.
West Virginia artist Jeff Pearson just wrapped up a unique assignment for the Charleston Gazette Mail. As a sketch artist, he spent 11 weeks inside the federal courtroom during the trial of ex-Massey CEO Don Blankenship, who was convicted of conspiring to break mine safety laws. West Virginia Public Broadcasting also contracted Jeff Pearson during the trial and used his sketches on WVPublic.org. At first glance, Pearson's drawings are quite different from the sketches of most courtroom artists. For one thing, he used a lot of expressive blues and red colors, and the faces he drew are vivid with emotion. So Roxy Todd brought him into the studio to talk more about why he chose this style for his courtroom pictures and what it was like to be in that courtroom day after day.
Central Appalachia, where coal reigns supreme. Many people said the trial of Don Blankenship was something they had never imagined. Never before has a top American coal executive been convicted of crimes related to the deaths of miners. The trial was emotionally intense for the family members who lost loved ones in the disaster at Upper Big Branch in 2010. Many of them traveled each day to Charleston to watch. Cameras aren't allowed in federal court for criminal trials, so two local artists were hired by the media to capture the trial. One of them is Jeff Pearson, who's never sketched as a courtroom artist before. Jeff normally spends his days teaching art to elementary school children. He's also illustrated children's books and painted outdoor murals.
So, as an illustrator, one of the things that I love about illustration is that we're storytellers. And so, as far back as I can remember, even as a kid, I love telling stories with pictures, and in particular, images of people's faces. And you can tell a lot of stories through folks' faces, and that's what I do in almost every illustration that I've done. And so being hired to be the courtroom artist for the Blankenship trial was a perfect match for me because I could see those stories happening in that courtroom through those faces of the people involved. My job there was to kind of observe what was happening. Part of that is watching their face, facial expressions, mannerisms. Not so much what they were saying, but what they were doing with their body language. I can almost feel what they were feeling in the case just by watching them.
But Jeff had to figure out how to adapt his style to become a courtroom sketch artist. This was especially important as he figured out how he was going to depict Don Blankenship.
I tend to exaggerate things a little bit visually. And going into the trial, I had to make sure that I kind of kept my drawings very realistic as opposed to kind of caricature or exaggeration. But with a man of this nature who's kind of, he is kind of a cartoon or a caricature, and I had to be really careful not to do that. But I also think that sometimes you can capture someone's expression a little bit better by exaggerating.
Jeff says he tried to observe every detail of Don Blankenship's face and his body language and see if he could detect what he was feeling.
When you look at Don Blankenship, when you look at Most people, when you look at a photograph of him, that, you know, even the ones that he, when he was coming out of the courtroom, there was such a lack of emotion. People often said that his face was stoic, and that how do you capture any kind of emotion from Don Blankenship? But I think when you're seeing him in person in that courtroom, there's a lot there, actually, and especially in the eyes. In the eyes, again, when you look at a photograph of Don Blankenship, they almost look like there's nothing there. It's just kind of dead eyes. But when I saw him in the courtroom, especially that first day when you're looking at him there, so there's a lot there. There's a lot behind those eyes. And that's what I was trying to capture in this image. You know, there, he may not show it, but he's thinking about this. He's thinking about it a lot. And I think a lot of people would say that he doesn't, you know, he may not care what's going on. And truth of the matter is, I don't know. But there's something there. There was definitely something there in that courtroom that he was definitely trying to hide, you know, trying to stay solid. But there was some emotion there.
One of Jeff's first sketches was of Don Blankenship during the first day of the trial. The sketch shows dark circles under Blankenship's eyes.
His posture was very relaxed. He had his arm up on a chair, an empty chair beside him in the courtroom. I just felt like he was very relaxed and as if he didn't care so much about what was going on around him, as if he were in his own little world. And then I started studying his face. And one thing that I'm really interested in, again, is people's face and what stories are telling through those facial expressions. And you can tell a lot through the eyes. And with this particular image, I was trying to capture a little bit of his humanity in this process and in this situation that he had found himself in. And I saw a lot of sadness, but I also saw some contempt for the process and for what was happening around him. And when I sent this image to a friend of mine out west who knew nothing about the trial. And I asked them to describe the image in two words. And roughly, they described it with those two words, sadness and contempt.
An image like this that captures so much and almost tells more than the average viewer would even see. Like you're digging in a little bit more than we would see in like a photograph, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So how much of that process is, as a courtroom sketch artist, like do you have to kind of decide, well, how much of this emotion am I licensed to show?
I think it's my job. I think as the observer, I'm there to do what the cameras can't do, which the cameras are not there, so that we can't capture actual images in real time of what's happening. So my job is to capture that image of what's happening in that particular day. But I also think it is my job to capture that emotion of what's happening in their faces and what's going through their heads. Obviously, I'm not inside their head, but I try to capture that the best I can through image.
At the end of this long process, which other sketches stand out for you?
So one of the things that I was asked to do was capture some of the families observing the trial. And one family in particular was Gary and Patty Quarles. And my job was to kind of capture their observance of the trial. And I decided to draw the back of Gary's head looking at Don. He would often kind of glance over at Don Blankenship. And that's what I decided to capture with Gary. Although we don't see his face, I think there's a lot of emotion that was caught just by him looking at Mr. Blankenship during that trial. Even when I was in my role of functioning as an illustrator covering the trial, that was the most emotional sketch in itself. It was an emotional piece.
As far as the families, I know you've written a little bit on Facebook just about how much you admire them making the trip day in and day out, making these long journeys, and just how impressed you were with their diligence to be there, and more than anybody. It definitely, I would imagine, the family members, it took so much out of them. Did you see any of that, you know, when you're observing them day in and day out? Just did they change over the 2.5 months, do you think?
Yeah. Let me say this first. The family members, I've mentioned this on social media and things like that as I'm kind of wrapping my head around the completion of this trial for me personally. And to say it was this trial, I didn't expect this, but the trial really impacted me deeply, and I learned a lot and kind of shared those emotions of the magnitude of what was happening and what might have happened and those kind of things. And we became very close with the family members. We were there in close quarters for a number of hours a day and was able to get to really know these folks. And as the trial went on, as we knew that the verdict was coming soon, and the couple days leading up to it, we all kind of had a sense that it was coming because it had been some time had passed and we knew that the jury must be wrapping up, although some days we weren't sure. When we knew that it was getting close, those family members became a little more They didn't talk as much. They became a little more quiet, a little more emotional. And we still interacted, but it was a little more quiet. They were a little more reserved in their conversations and their interactions with some of the other media folks that were there. But they were just, it was great to get to know them. And we became, I mean, truly, we became family. And you know, I'd never met these people before in my life and maybe never see them again. But that last day after that verdict, you know, when I said goodbye to them, it was tough because I know that the impact that this has had on them, obviously, and to get this verdict, I think some of them were unhappy and some of them were, you know, they spoke out in the media. We've heard what they've had to say. And I think that there's some closure, but, you know, some of them didn't get the closure they expected. And there's one family member in particular that when he was emotional, it was hard not to be emotional about it. And it was hard not to feel his pain and his suffering and his grief. And that was Gary. And when Gary was upset, I had to walk away. It was really tough for us to see him be upset about this.
But Jeff says there wasn't the same kind of camaraderie behind the scenes between Blankenship and the media the way there was with the family members. And he recalls that as the verdicts came in, Blankenship was even more withdrawn and quiet.
Some of the other sketches that were important to me were, of course, the verdict. I mean, when the verdict came in, as these things go, it went fairly fast. It was a matter of seconds, truly, to capture what was he doing. My focus was Don Blankenship. So what was his emotion? Although we know that he doesn't show much. Going back to that earlier sketch, what is he saying now with his eyes? What is he saying now with his posture? And so I had to capture that in a matter of seconds, and Bill Taylor happened to be in that sketch as well. And I tried to capture that emotion the same way I did the first time, just trying to see, observe, and then run out of the courtroom and finish that sketch up so it can get out there in the world, you know, for people to use and those kind of things. That was, obviously the verdict was a high important piece for that.
What did you see?
When the verdict was read, to be honest, you know, I would love to romanticize it, but there was nothing. I mean, some of the emotions I was able to see early on in the trial from Mr. Blankenship, when the verdict was read, he did a really good job of keeping his emotions at bay. And even earlier, and I think this is a running joke, he never shows any emotions ever. But there were certain days that I was able to see it. When that verdict was read, there was nothing. And, I mean, the only thing, and this is such a minute little thing that he did, when the verdict was read, the first count was read first, and he said they found him guilty, there was a subtle, very subtle draw of the eyebrow. I mean, it was ever so subtle. You almost would have to have binoculars to see it. In fact, there was one guy had binoculars in the case, which is another story. But you had to really kind of be watching him, just kind of staring at his face. And that was my job. That's what I did that last moment, was watching that face and seeing what happens. And there was a subtle draw of the eyebrow, and that's what I drew. And that was all there was.
We've been listening to an interview with courtroom sketch artist Jeff Pearson chatting with Roxy Todd. We've posted some of his sketches from the Blankenship trial on our website at wvpublic.org. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear about a new art project Jeff is planning now that the Blankenship trial is over. I'm Jessica Lilly. This is Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. Today we've been hearing from Jeff Pearson, the artist who made the sketches you may have seen in the newspaper or on our website during the trial of former Massey CEO Don Blankenship. As we mentioned earlier, Jeff hasn't always been a courtroom sketch artist. And now that the Blankenship trial is over, he's back doing his regular work as an elementary school art teacher and a freelance artist. In this next part of Roxy's conversation with Jeff Pearson, we'll hear about a new mural in West Virginia he'll be working on soon.
The community leaders in Whitesville, near where the Upper Big Branch mine disaster occurred in 2010, asked Jeff to help make a mural for their town. That mural will be done as a series of freestanding panels in the middle of the Whitesville Miners Memorial Park. Each panel will show a scene from the town's history, the old general stores, and people who first settled the area. Jeff will also paint present-day scenes like kayakers and Boy Scouts who visit Whitesville to paddle the Coal River.
Is there anything you're hoping or feeling about that mural project?
You know, that's a great question, because when I took on the mural in Whitesville, all I knew about the tragedy, obviously, and knew how tough it is for the folks down there in that part of the state. But now, knowing the families and having kind of a firsthand interaction with them, I'm going to approach it differently, truly, because although my mural is not based on the accident or the tragedy, but it is based on that community and trying to, you know, find some positive things about their community and try to move on and have some strength. So that's definitely going to be part of it emotionally. Yeah.
Jeff's mural in Whitesville won't be his first community art project. Over the years, Jeff has painted murals in Charleston, Fayetteville, and Princeton. As a matter of fact, that outdoor art in Princeton is part of a growing community mural project.
What's happened in Princeton, there's two artists that are there, Robert Blankenship and Lori McKinney, actually their husband and wife, and they've created this mural process that's unbelievable. So a town that had one mural 5 years ago now has over 10. And it's continuing to grow. And it's just unbelievable the energy that's in that town now because of the artwork. It's truly a story of how art can change a community.
How can art change a community? Besides just the example of more energy coming into mm-hmm. Princeton, we're hearing so many stories of job decline in the coal fields and sure. people all over Appalachia searching for things that could help. I mean, how can art help communities?
There's several ways to look at how art can revitalize a community. What's happening in Princeton, I'll use it again as an example, there are actually artists that are moving to Princeton and building their livelihood, their careers in Princeton. Their studios are in Princeton. They're traveling there because it's an artful town now. That's happened in other places throughout the state where people go because they want to be around like-minded people. And what's happening in those areas, they become tourist attractions because of the art. And people go there to buy the work and to see the work. So you're seeing artists be part of that tourism.
Jeff's mural in downtown Princeton features a legendary country and folk musician known as Blind Alfred Reed, who died in 1956. Jeff painted Reed on the side of a white brick building in his usual exaggerated style. Reed has huge ears and a pompadour on a head so big it makes his fiddle look tiny. If you drive through downtown Princeton, you can't miss it. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
Yeah, I live not too far from that mural, and every time we drive past, my five-year-old says, "Mommy, that man's got a big head." Here's a tune from Blind Alfred Reed called "Walking in the Way with Jesus."
Come all you people around, listen what I have to say. I'll sing you a song about the heavenly throne. Thank God I'm on my way. I've traveled the paths of sin, and many a crime I've done. But I trust in God, and through Christ's blood, thank God the victory's won.
That's the late Blind Alfred Reed, who's depicted in a downtown mural by Jeff Pearson in Princeton, West Virginia, just down the street from me. Most of the murals are on Mercer Street, which I visited back in 2013 when most of the first murals were being painted. Amateur and professional painters helped bring fresh colors to the street. I caught up with professional Appalachian artist and Princeton native Patch Whiskey back then, while he was creating his masterpiece. His work often features colorful cartoon-like creatures in sort of trippy, abstract scenes. He climbed down from a bucket truck to take a break from painting, set down his rattle cans, and chat.
I mean, every mural that I do, I'm dropping rainbow monsters on people, and I don't really have sketches for anything that I'm doing, so I pretty much just kind of attack the wall, you know, and kind of go at it, and the story kind of unfolds as I keep painting. In this particular mural, there's a rainbow monster stumbled across a bubble-to-bubble salesman. He sells mystery boxes.
Whiskey's work can be found across the East Coast in cities like Charleston, South Carolina, Miami, Florida, and now his hometown, Princeton. The mural project was one of the first that was led by the Princeton Renaissance Project, a group of local folks with a vision for the region. They wanted to do something about the rundown reality of empty storefronts and crime like prostitution and drug dealing. Patch told me back in 2013 that he'd observed that kind of thing going on Mercer Street.
I just see some people here that put on their shoes and they go to work. But their work's a little different from, you know, a 9-to-5 office shift, you know. They're kind of freelancers, I guess, you know, in a way. They find different ways from the guy that pushes the shopping buggy down the street collecting cans, you know. I mean, there's different ways to make money out here, I guess.
Since the community started investing into downtown through the Princeton Renaissance Project, some new businesses have moved in, some didn't last, but an art gallery, music school, and a used bookstore have lasted several years. And the town still has a downtown church and a post office, and recently renovated its public library. There's even a community garden now, right under Patch Whiskey's Rainbow Monster mural. The challenges of crime in the area haven't gone away completely, but the community doesn't let that discourage them. And last year, a new project added even more vibrant colors to the buildings. The Princeton Renaissance Project worked to restore what they call ghost murals. You see, at one time, Princeton, like a lot of small towns, used to be a shopping hub for passengers of the Virginian Railway. And a lot of those stores were painted with their name and logo, or with ads for products those stores sold, like Coca-Cola. But in 1955, the passenger trains made their last run through Princeton, and the paint started to fade. Now, in addition to the new murals, people are bringing back the look of old-fashioned downtown by revitalizing some of the ghost murals. The latest outdoor advertisement to be restored was in the historic district. The part of Mercer Street houses a railroad museum, a daycare, a motorcycle and tattoo shop, along with an old TV repair shop that's only open at random times. Greg Puckett is a volunteer with the Princeton Renaissance Project. He's also a county commissioner and executive director of Community Connections, a nonprofit organization based in southern West Virginia. The project has put him in a bucket truck for much of this past summer, and I caught up with him as he was putting the finishing touches on the Stag mural. Looking up here at the mural, it's really bright red and yellow, and the letters are done in white. On top it says the Stag Clothing Co., and then below it the letters in white are traced in black, and it says Carter and Mason, proprietors, everything for men and boys. So what do we know about Carter and Mason, or this clothing company?
It was a place where people like myself, even in the 70s and 80s, would go with my dad, and the very first suit that I ever bought was at the Stag. You really started, you know, attaching back into the feel of what it was like to go into a true men's store, you know, where you've got ties and shoes and shirts that are all specifically set out for the particular purpose of, you know, putting apparel on men. And so, you know, I was with my dad and it was a great moment for me. And so to kind of come down and look at this mural and, you know, as I'm working on this over a period of time, it let me go back and it let me recapture that nostalgia of what life, this town was like for me growing up. It was by far the most challenging, and it's certainly the most colorful. But it.
Now, what were those challenges?
The problem was the brick. The brick is very porous. It's very deep crevices, and when it was originally done, you could tell where they took the time and they really filled the brick in. But over the many years, and the last time this one was painted was probably about the 1950s. You know, 60 years worth of weatherization pretty much wore it all off. So when we had to go back in, we've layered the brick in. To try to make sure that we get the color in as rich as possible.
And as a resident here, it's important to you, and I'm sure those personal connections really you know, make you feel good about this project. But more than that, what do you think the creating this sense of nostalgia that, you know, people might be able to experience whenever they come back to Princeton, or if they come to Princeton, why is that so important to this community at this time?
The murals on this, by repainting them in the classic style and exactly the way that they were done with new coat of paint and really just adapting the new color scheme to match what they had back then, really attaches that sense of history. So you capture every single generation. Even now, you know, we've got photographers that come down into this part of town that photograph this area because the murals are here, because they can do black and white and they've got a brand new canvas that it looks like you're stepping back in time. So, you know, it's a beneficial thing for everybody, and we're excited. You know, this is the fourth mural that we've done, but we've got at least probably 5 to 6 more murals to do next year.
The project started last year with the most visible ghost mural for Lynch's. That was a clothing store on Mercer Street that opened in the 1930s. It took Puckett and other volunteers a few weeks to finish restoring the fading paint from the old outdoor advertisement. Puckett says the volunteers seemed more inspired after the first mural was completed.
It just spurred on the energy. And then from there, it took a little bit more time. We painted other buildings downtown, but we didn't work on a mural. This last year, we ended up doing one on top of the building of the old Spangler building, which was a drugstore downtown. And it says on the top, it says Spangler's for drugs and drinks. And of course, you know, this drugs and drinks has a different connotation nowadays than it had back then. Back then, you had a drugstore, you came in, you went to the fountain, and it was, you know, it had that sense of nostalgia. So we did that, and then it was an overwhelming response. Facebook really blew up on that one, and we knew that we were really on to something. From there, we did another small one this past summer, which was the Haddon Building, which was another clothing store. And we knew that the Stag was one of those ones where we just had to tackle. But, it, you know, it's a fairly large mural. You're looking at least 20 feet wide, and you're looking at about 8 to 10 feet high. It's you know, it's an impressive mural down at the eastern end of town. That has taken a long time, but we also know that, you know, they make statements, and the bigger you go, the more statement you're going to have. So that's kind of where we were. We actually did find another one, which was the Crush mural. We did find one for Orange Crush, which was not included on the list of, you know, where stores were, but when we found it, we just knew we had to do something to restore that as well.
Okay, Crush is still around.
It is, you know, and that's the thing is that, you know, it is a product that is still regularly bought. But when you go back and you look at the old images, we knew that that was one we had to bring back.
Have you always been an artist?
No, you know.
You've been a ball player, right?
Yeah, I'm more of a ball player.
Greg plays on a basketball team called the Drug-Free All-Stars. The team tours the state to play games for elementary school students. It's something my daughter looks forward to at her school. The team's mission is to promote a drug-free lifestyle. It's a project sponsored by Community Connections, and Greg also assisted with the youth swimming team, and the ghost mural restoration work isn't the first time he's painted outdoors either.
Ironically enough, I designed my own mail pouch tobacco barn on a barn at home. So, but I used a
there you go.
I used a PowerPoint projector, and I started there, and then I realized, well, if I can do that, I can certainly come back and do some of the restoration. So it's been a lot of fun, and it's a lot of work, but it's definitely one of those volunteer projects that I've truly enjoyed.
After all, spending much of your summer with a bird's eye view of your hometown in a bucket truck can't be all that bad. And I guess it's probably helped contribute for your tan there this summer, huh?
It does great for the tan. It doesn't do much for the weariness of the legs or the arms, but yeah, for the tan, it's not so bad.
I think you missed a spot.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I think you did. It's right there.
Well, I've got a brush in the car. You can grab that.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I see how it is.
Yeah, that's
good.
Thanks,
Greg.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Inside Appalachia. On today's show, we've been talking about outdoor murals in Appalachia. This next part of our journey will probably take you to some familiar places because, well, you've probably seen them. Barns with faded paint, usually in black or red with yellow lettering, delivering an old message from another time. Chew mail pouch and treat yourself to the best. Once upon a time, these hand-painted tobacco advertisements covered more than 20,000 barns all across America. The mail pouch barn painting movement all started in the dry goods store in West Virginia, and it changed the face of advertising across the country. Chuck Klein has this story about the Wheeling-based tobacco company behind Mail Pouch Tobacco.
Stuart Block is the former president of the Mail Pouch Company in Wheeling, West Virginia. His great-grandfather was one of the two Block brothers that founded the company in 1879. The brothers had a dry goods store on Main Street in Wheeling. As a side business, they made cigars in a loft above the store.
In the course of making the cigars, they had all these clippings. They didn't really know what to do with them, so they packaged up the clippings from the cigar business to create a new brand type of chewing tobacco. And they flavored it with molasses and licorice and so forth.
And they had to come up with a name. Back in the late 1800s, one of the highlights in the day of the life was getting mail. People in Wheeling would line up on the banks of the Ohio River, anticipating the arrival of the Mail Pouch bag. The Block brothers took the popular thought and ran with it as the name for their new product, Mail Pouch Tobacco. And the Ohio River had one other major impact on the Block brothers' business.
We had a big flood in 1886, I think. Flooded out the downstairs in the dry goods store. The cigar making was okay upstairs, so they bought a sugar mill down on 40th Street and transferred the tobacco end of the business, but got out of the dry goods business. And the company moved to its current location, where there are still 160 people working, making chewing tobacco and stuff.
Many people believe the key to the Mail Pouch success was the advertising. It was in the early 1900s when Stuart Block's grandfather, Jess Block, came up with the idea to advertise on barns along highways. Signs can still be seen today in 39 states.
Farmers were interested in having their barn painted, and we were interested in putting up the famous Mail Pouch barn sign, "Treat Yourself to the Best." Crews were organized to paint the barn signs, and an individual was hired to lease the space from the farmer. We got a cut rate, I think, for the advertising cost, because in the beginning we paid the farmer with an annual subscription of the Saturday Evening Post or Collier's. Most of your listeners probably don't even know those magazines, but they were popular then. Life magazine was another one. And then in the later years, we paid cash for the space.
The Ohio Valley's industry helped drive the chewing tobacco market. In the steel mills, coal mines, and in the oil and gas industries, workers could not smoke, so they chewed Mail Pouch tobacco instead. When the oil and gas workers moved to the fields out west, the barn paintings followed. Of course, everything was hand-painted in those days, and the most famous Mail Pouch painter by far was Harley Warrick. For 55 years, he painted or retouched over 20,000 Mail Pouch signs.
He was remarkable in that he could paint those signs by himself. He'd put a sling up on top of the roof, stand on it, pull it up, paint it, lower it. It's remarkable. He painted the Mail Pouch sign at the World's Fair. He painted them in restaurants. He painted them for individuals who want them in their rec room. He painted a lot of signs. And he was a very gregarious guy. So he always enjoyed talking to the farmers where he was painting the signs. And he'd be back about every 3 years, 3 to 4 years, and renew his acquaintances with the farmers. And it was an existence that he really enjoyed. I did learn the other day that in the beginning, the barn painters would take their families with them in the summer, and they'd camp with their kids and their wife while they painted signs in that area, and then they'd move on.
In 1965, the Federal Beautification Act sought to restrict the vast number of local advertisements that were being placed near highways.
All federal highways required that billboards be removed. Well, Mail Pouch signs were on federal highways in many, many places. So I contacted our Senator Jennings Randolph and suggested that maybe Mail Pouch barn signs were a part of Americana that should be preserved. And he agreed.
Senator Randolph did manage to get the barn paintings exempt. After the Highway Beautification Act, just about all other sign painters went out of business. Yet Harley Warwick continued to paint and retouch older mail pouch signs on the back roads until his retirement in 1991. Yet most of the mail pouch barn paintings were again left untouched, cited as pieces of historical Americana.
That was Chuck Klein reporting on the classic mail pouch tobacco murals, which started right here in Appalachia. So it kind of makes sense that the originals inspired a way to encourage folks to quit tobacco. It's another project spearheaded by Greg Puckett, the guy we heard from earlier who spent so much of his time in a bucket truck this past summer. Well, yeah, another one of Greg's missions is to try to get people to quit using tobacco and not to start in the first place. It's part of his role as the executive director of the nonprofit organization Community Connections. But he's also a fan of the historical mail pouch barn murals. As a matter of fact, he painted his own mail pouch tobacco mural on his barn in his own yard. He told us about it earlier in the show, you might remember. Anyway, this new project has some mail pouch undertones.
It's basically taking the history of mail pouch tobacco barns in the state of West Virginia, which, you know, is very rich and deeply entrenched in our history, and changing it over to saying, okay, well, we've got a negative product in tobacco. How do we change it and make it something that's more along the lines of prevention? And so we took these quote-unquote prevention barns, and we started a process where we're, you know, telling people, hey, there's a number if you need help to quit spit tobacco, which is snuff or rub or however you know, people term it, or quit smoking. And, you know, there's a phone number available, but we use the cultural icon of the barns in which to help tell the message.
Puckett says he was inspired to create this project during a drive along the back roads of West Virginia.
The barn strategy was one where I was driving to go up to the Eastern Panhandle, and as I was driving through, I love history, and there were about eight barns along my drive on 219 and up 50 and several others, and I kept thinking to myself, going, wow, what if we just had this opportunity to do something different? And so I had gone
So you had seen these barns that had the old ghost murals on them?
They were, you know, and they had chew mail pouch, treat yourself to the best. And, you know, I love the idea of the advertising. And I just thought, you know, as an ad guy, as a communications guy, I just kept thinking, this is a great opportunity. We can do something different. So I went to the...
Were you frustrated to see those, though? Like, they were still, you know, they still had a message. You love history, but were you frustrated to see them?
Well, you know, from a prevention side, yes, but from a cultural side, no. In fact, if you come to my office today, my office is inundated with advertising that says, chew mail pouch, treat yourself to the best. So, but it's also a great reminder because it's like, hey, this is what was, and how can we change what was to make what is or what will be? And I think that was extremely important to me. And it was really the sort of the catalyst to get me thinking forward. And so I never look back at history and say it was a bad idea. It might have been a failed idea or it might have been something that we didn't like, but yet it's still a way to move forward in a different direction.
Now, as you travel along West Virginia's back roads, you'll find several mail pouch tobacco ghost murals, which are considered historical. But you'll also find some forward-thinking ads that promote a healthier lifestyle. Greg said it took some convincing before the West Virginia Division of Tobacco Prevention would agree to fund the first prevention mural, which was painted in Monroe County, West Virginia. The barn quickly gained the attention of three national journals as a successful and clever prevention campaign. Puckett says after that, it was easier to convince the folks at the division to fund more prevention barn murals. Those funds went to pay barn owners $500 to secure the canvas for 10 years. Greg found the second barn at the base of Bent Mountain, just outside of Athens, and one day he decided to knock on the door to see if the owner would be interested in having her barn painted.
I'm Greta Johnston. I'm the owner of the Black Barn on Route 20 in Mercer County with the mural. What does it say? I think it says quit spit tobacco.
quit spit tobacco. It works for me. And even if it don't say it, it's a good message.
Well, it's on the front of it. We'll have to see what's on the front of it.
Okay. Greta Johnston moved to Mercer County from Maryland with her husband around 1969. Miss Johnston was kind enough to walk with me to get a closer look at the barn.
It's warming up out here. Look at that frost. It was a big frost on this morning. Was there a big frost in Athens?
There was. Yeah. My son was talking about how there was snow on the vehicles. You have a beautiful view out here.
Well, it's pretty in the summertime when the trees has leaves on them, and I have a lot of flowers, and I like to get out and plant flowers.
The barn towers over a flock of sheep as we get closer. Its black paint contrasts the words "quit, spit tobacco" in white and yellow, then the number of a national hotline people can call if they want help to quit tobacco, painted in green. And finally, the words "treat yourself to health," playing on the mail pouch, "treat yourself to the best," slogan is written in white.
Well, when he approached me and told me about it, I thought, oh yeah, that's a good idea. You know, I like the, always admired barns that had different murals and things painted on them. And so I thought, well, why not, you know? So I told him yes.
And it seems like a pretty good location right here next to the road,
it
too.
It is, especially if you're headed towards Athens, you know, going east. You can see it better than you can coming from Athens.
Did it mean anything to you to be a part of raising awareness about tobacco use and trying to prevent tobacco use at all?
Oh, yes. I think it would bring, you know, a lot of attention to people, especially young men. I know my grandson one time was in the car and he was chewing tobacco, you know, and I said, you know, I have a barn that says quit spit tobacco on it.
Did it work?
I think it worked because I don't believe he chews that tobacco now.
Well, good.
You know, it can cause cancer, and so I haven't seen him chewing tobacco, and I thought of that the other week, and I thought, I'm going to ask his wife if he's still chewing tobacco, but I don't believe he is.
That was Greta Johnston, owner of the barn on Route 20 that says Quit Spit Tobacco just outside of Athens. Greta had one of the first prevention barns in West Virginia. It was painted back in 2007. Since then, there have been variations of the color scheme. There are even some pink barns that promote breast cancer awareness. And since it's gotten some national attention, maybe we'll even see the project expand across the country, just as the mail pouch tobacco murals did back in the day. That's our show. It's kind of nice to see some forward-thinking projects coming out of Appalachia. Of course, they've always been here. Maybe people just didn't know where to look or just haven't ventured down to the back roads and hollers of this great place. I'm so glad you came with us. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Ben Townsend, Jake Sheps, the Glenville State Bluegrass Band, Blind Alfred Reed, Andy Agnew Jr., and Alabama. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.